You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Yeah, it's like, I feel very isolated, even though the fact that, like, it's clearly in a market.
Like, and, like, everybody can look in. It's like a little fish tank, and, like, we're just like,
yeah, I feel like I'm in a museum or something.
This is East Side Story, and I'm your host, Chiang Eun. Each week, I sit down with an Asian or Asian American artist working in the New York theater scene, and I excavate their life story. How they grew up, how they got their start in theater, as well as projects they've worked on and upcoming work that we should anticipate. This week's guest is Cynthia Meng. Cynthia, music assisted on the musical Hadestown, which won 8 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. And she also music assisted on Grace McLean's In the Green that played at Lincoln Center. I finally got to work with Cynthia for one of Musical Theatre Factory's concerts, and I was struck by her positivity, musicianship, and the way she commanded a room with precision and confidence. This episode is recorded with Listening Party inside Canal Street Radio. Shout out!
Tell everybody a little bit more about yourself and who you are, what you do, and a little tidbit.
Cool. I'm Cynthia. Cynthia Meng. Meng, technically, I guess.
Yes.
And, I'm a music director, pianist, sometimes composer, but I really wouldn't bill myself that way. But I work a lot in theater, and I used to be a software engineer. That was also something I used to do, and this was kind of a recent career change for me. So
I love it. Yeah. Wait, can I ask how old you are? Is that a taboo question?
No, it's not taboo. I'm 25.
Oh my God, you're a baby.
That's really funny because, I mean, I don't know. I'm doing assistant work now, and sometimes it feels like I'm old to be an assistant.
No, but
it does because you see all these kids coming out of school,
yeah.
And I'm like, okay, well, I'm not like right out of school anymore. Like I will acknowledge, like obviously, like I'm not like old, but you know there are those young whippersnappers coming out of college, and I am definitely not that. So
yeah, you're only 3 years older. Calm down.
I know, but I think that's part of growing up is that you feel older than like the people who are younger than you. You're like I just feel so old compared to you. Like you're 21 and right out of school, and I'm like I already have a few years under my belt. So like,
yes, just imagine. Give it a few more years, and you'd be like. Like I'm 45. No, I'm not 45. But like, it feels like I'm 45. And I'm like, oh God.
But the great news is Asian don't raisin. So like,
we're gonna look
young and do it.
People constantly think I am like 18. I'm like, okay, great. Sure. I'll take it. Why not? Share a little bit about your background, how you grew up, where you grew up, how you grew up, what kind of environment were you in?
Cool. My parents are immigrants. Mm-hmm. They came from China in 89. Mm. They were students when they came, they got their master's degrees here. Mm. And so I was born in the States. I'm the eldest of three. So
wow.
I was born in the States and then born in Chicago, lived there for like a little bit, but like not enough to remember anything. And then moved to California. And that's where I lived and grew up. So I lived in the Bay Area, mm-hmm. and which was an interesting place to grow up. I played classical piano like every good Chinese kid that I knew. I grew up playing classical piano, so I was trained from a very young age. I think, when I was like 5 or 6, playing little preludes and stuff. And I did the competition route. That was, I don't mean this to, I'm not shading like my parents or my teachers, because I do appreciate all the things that I grew up with, but the competition thing was horrible. It was really bad for me. Like,
why?
I don't know. I think that when you put that kind of pressure on a kid, like a young kid, and I don't know, everyone gets like very competitive around like, for, you know, who gets the prize and stuff.
Yeah.
So it was so much pressure, and I really felt that as a kid. And as a result, at least with the type of personality I was, maybe I just would like choke. Like that was like my thing, like choking under pressure. So I would, you have this piece, you practice, whatever, you memorize all these things, and then you get up on the stage and all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I can't do that. I forgot how to play piano, you know? And that was really like, it was a pretty big part of my life, and it was very, I was the least happy when I was
competing.
Like, I think that was the truth, and because I loved playing, and there were, I don't know, like there were just so many moments where I was like, I feel like I don't like this, but I also really do like it. And I couldn't figure out why. And obviously now in hindsight, it's like, okay, well, I didn't love the fact that I had to be put in these like super high pressure situations that ultimately now in my life like don't matter at all.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, that was my introduction to music.
Did all three of your, like you and your two siblings, did you all go through the same thing?
We all did. I was definitely the most intense one. Oh. And then like each progressive sibling was like less. So part of me was like, ah, oh, you guys like, don't know. Like,
you paved the way.
Right.
So,
I mean, and they saw, you know, they definitely saw the emotional toll it took. Yeah. I mean, all like 50% of the fights that I would have with my parents were about this.
Wow.
Like, were about like, oh, like I you know, either like you're not practicing hard enough or blah, blah, blah. It's like because you're not like, you know, showing the results, you know, or me being like, oh, like I just want to play like fun stuff too. And there was something about it because like you would go and like the competitions and like your parents like all talk to each other, right? And like,
yeah.
And they mingle with each other and they're all talking Chinese, you know? So it is like in some ways like a part of growing up, it, not just Chinese, but like, or Asian, but Asian American too. Because mm-hmm. it felt in some ways like it wasn't necessarily you competing. It was you competing
on behalf of your entire family.
Exactly.
Yep. And then you have to like, yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. Yep. And that's where the weight comes from. That's where the pressure comes from, because you're like, oh my God, it's not just about me doing well. It's about like showing that my family is good at this thing.
Yeah.
It was bizarre.
Wow. And then when did it change? I mean, you went to college for
computer science.
Right.
Yeah.
So clearly it didn't change that drastically.
Well, it was just weird. First, so I guess to backtrack even further, like when I was in middle school, I was in choir and I could sing, so I was in choir and we sang For Good.
Yeah.
Sorry, at our middle school graduation.
It's cute.
No, it's great. So cute. And like I was like, what is this? Like, this is weird and doesn't sound like anything else that we've ever sung. And that's how I discovered musical theater. So oh, you know, I mean, it was true. Wicked was like a huge turning point in my life. And once I figured out what musical theater was, and then there was like this kind of like theater, like community theater troupe, like in the area, and I got to be a part of that. And of course, the schools are always looking for free labor, so like they're like, great, like this sixth grader can play piano, like just let's just have them play piano. So
free for right, free,
right? So I would, you know, play in a company, and that's how I learned that aspect of playing piano and what it meant to be a collaborative pianist and stuff.
So if like music was such a huge part of your life throughout high school, why go into, you know, computer science?
Yeah, it's a good question. I went to college and it was just very much expected. It was like, dude, like this is, you know, you do these things because they enrich your life as a high schooler, and then you get a
real job.
You get a practical degree. And
yeah.
I think I felt that too. And
where did you go to college?
I went to Harvard.
Oh. Casually. She just casually dropped that. She was just, I went to Harvard. Yeah. Like it's just what you do. Like just Harvard, duh. Like where else would I go?
No, I mean,
rude.
Yeah, that's where I went to school. But yeah, so and when I was there, it was kind of like, okay, well, I don't know what I want to do. Of course, you go and undecided, you don't declare before you go. And then I was there and did the first year. I took this introductory computer science course. Both my parents are programmers, and I was like, this is cool. I liked it. You know what?
You were good at it.
And I was good at it. And, yeah. I did like it. And I do like it. And I didn't know at the time either that I would be interested in music direction, because I didn't know that was a thing. That was another thing. I didn't know that this job that I now do or the things that I do was a thing.
When you were exposed to theater as a kid, was it like you were exposed only in school and like not part of your family exposure?
Definitely not.
So it was just like your own little experience.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, my parents like knew about it because they knew me, and I would talk about it, or I would like beg them to buy the like vocal selections book from Hal Leonard, you know, this kind of thing. I mean, I have this very distinct memory of my mom like bringing me to see Wicked in LA, because I really wanted to go see it, and it was the regional production. It was at the
touring production. Yeah
I guess it must have been at the Pantages, sorry. Yeah.
And big theater.
Yeah. And my mom, we bought these like scalped tickets from this guy in his backyard. We like drove to his house. It was like a family trip to LA, and like my mom was like, okay, I found these like cheap tickets like on Craigslist or something. And
we went
to this guy's house, and then we went to see Wicked together.
Wow.
And that was my first show, and it was really, really cool. I was so excited. And so they facilitated that in a way.
Yeah.
And that's a very fond memory. Like I will always have.
Yeah. I always say that Wicked's my first show, but truly it's not. Mary Poppins is my first musical. But I got into musical theater very, very late, like in 2010. 10.
Oh, wow. Okay, that is late. Yeah.
So late.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, wait, what?
Wow.
I know. I mean, I didn't grow up here, so my exposure
I guess
to theater.
That's true.
But I find, because I've been talking to so many people, the threat of like theater not being a part of their lives as part of their family tradition.
Mm-hmm. It's
a big deal, especially to Asian people, and how we eventually end up in theater.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a miracle.
It is, you know, it's just it because it's such an it is such an American art form. Mm-hmm. And that's also partially why I think I was drawn to it as a kid. Like I felt like, oh, like this is like feels like very American. And
right. Up. Let's dig into what you just said.
Yeah.
Right. Like you said a little bit about you wanted to feel a little bit more American.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily that you didn't feel American, but just that all your living circumstances and how you grew up affected how you felt towards
yeah.
that. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I grew up in a predominantly white town. Mm-hmm. And like, and I will also say, like, there were not a lot of black people or Latino people, period, either. Mm-hmm. So like, it, you know, the next minority group down was Asian people. But mm-hmm. but at the same time, it was still mostly white. And like, there was definitely all my friends were white. And like, it was kind of like a thing that, oh, like, that's like so Asian of you to like do this thing, right?
That they would say that?
Yeah, there are things that were said to me that were like that. Or even that I would like say, you know, to be like, oh my God, like, I'm in on the joke, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And so, because classical piano, it actually did feel so like Asian to me, just because everyone around me was Asian and doing like
yeah.
classical piano.
Yeah.
That when I was playing modern music and when I learned to play by ear and play like pop songs and things like that, well, that felt very white to me and mm. American. And so in some ways that was what I think drew me to it. Cause it was like, this is different. This is different than the other stuff that I see. Like I definitely did sometimes feel like, oh, like my parents don't have this cultural background that so many of my other friends like share. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I would go over to a friend's house and her dad would like play Simon and Garfunkel and things like that. I have this such a clear memory of it. And he played guitar and it was great. And that's how I learned about Simon and Garfunkel.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not through my parents, but you know, the only thing my parents like really brought over with them in terms of like musical pop culture knowledge was like the Beatles, which was, you know, as universal as you
yeah,
can get.
Absolutely.
And so like getting to know those other art forms through people who were like my peers, as opposed to like the people that I was surrounded with in other facets of my life, was part of that.
Do you feel like during that time you actively ran away from what your parents associated with so that you could assimilate a little bit more with your peers?
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like, or were you even aware of what you
yeah,
were doing?
Yeah, I definitely would not have been aware of it mm-hmm. at the time. I certainly like, I wanted to do that more and oftentimes more than I wanted to play like the classical stuff. I think I really was drawn to the, you know, playing with people who are singing or me singing and playing at the same time. And so that I was attracted to, and I don't know if it necessarily was like a purposeful like, ugh, like fuck you to like like
right.
my culture, but
right.
it was a side effect of that, was that I kind of was like, well, this is cooler.
Mm.
Like, you know, and this is what gets people to kind of respect me in the social hierarchy of schools. Like, mm-hmm. oh, like you can play like Piano Man by Billy
yeah.
like stuff that like,
yeah.
people know, right?
Yeah. And instead
it's
of
pop.
But when you went to Harvard, let's talk a little bit
yeah.
about when you went to Harvard. How was that experience like? So you said that you took, it was practical reasons that you took computer science.
Mm-hmm.
Did you enjoy computer science while you were doing it?
Yeah.
And how did theater play a part in that journey at Harvard?
I did like computer science. I was really drawn to the way that you think as a software programmer. I mean, it was tough. I you know, I think it was very clear to my parents and to me that like, this is not necessarily, it wasn't like my destiny to do it. I think I chose that way for me. But like, you know, I had some really good friends that really helped me out, like during
from
that.
Computer science?
Yes. Like
oh.
I owe a lot to them in
mm-hmm.
that way.
So in what sense?
In that, like, I just felt like it was either that part of me like felt like I just like didn't want to do this for a living. And so I like maybe wasn't applying myself as hard in that way, or that I just, my brain was not naturally attuned to think in such ways. Anyways, I was doing a lot of theater at school. I music directed a few shows.
Was that your primary
No, actually, my, I would say my primary thing was singing in an a cappella group. That was like a huge...
Which a cappella group?
They were called the Harvard Callbacks.
Yes, Harvard Callbacks. Shout out.
Yes, exactly. Shout out. But yeah, and... You know, I arranged for them and I music directed the group at some point. And of course, you know, everything you hear about a cappella, and you know, you are in one as well. So, I mean, it's just madness. And they're my best friends, but I did do a lot of theater. And it was my second half of school that I actually became involved with this theater troupe at school called the Hasty Pudding. And that was like a student run, although heavily alumni funded organization.
That's great.
It was important for me because... Because I, as a composer for that organization, I was like the student conductor for 2 years. Mm-hmm. It was like eye-opening to me to be like, oh, like this is actually like, first of all, I love the process of putting up a show. Mm-hmm. I love the like going from writing the score and then like running it in the rehearsal room and making all the changes like as you go. Mm-hmm. And then the orchestration and the arrangements. And we had all these like pros like backing us up on that. That was like really eye-opening for me, kind of. Seeing the, some of the famous, like not famous, but like famous to me now, like alumni who came from that theater. I mean,
Larry O'Keefe came from that. Mm-hmm.
Nevin Steinberg, who's the sound designer on Hades Town, and a ton of other shows. Like he was also part of that. So you know, like later, like realizing all of these kind of like, oh, like this is a career path, and this is a viable kind of like job. The thing that I like to do, which is play piano and use the ability that I can sing and sight read and seeing what all these things, like all these skills are applicable to a job.
Right.
So,
but you still, and then it's still a leap, right? You still went from college into a job that had to do with computer science.
Yeah, so. I did that. And I, you know, I had a job and it was just like an inkling in my mind, this whole like music direction thing. But, and when I got a job, I knew I wanted to be in New York. And the idea was that I would come to New York and gig. That was always the plan.
So, like, you do your day job in the day and then you gig at night?
Yeah. And the great thing about software engineering is, I mean, it was really flexible. I had to give a shot. I got this job at a startup called Next Big Sound. They did data analytics for the music industry. Mm. Really cool stuff. And, like, I love this kind of thing, like data visualization and just what data means in various industries. And obviously, for me, the music industry was, like, super cool and interesting. But right before I graduated, they actually got acquired by Pandora Music Company. So yeah, and so before I even started, I went to Pandora. They weren't gone.
So
they
went to Pandora.
Yeah, they didn't get like liquidated or anything. They just like were like enveloped by the parent company.
Wow.
So then I was working for Pandora, but like for this like little company, and so I hustled quite a bit, and for the first year, I would say I kind of like played it safe. You know, in the following year and a half that I was there, I was gigging very heavily, and I think my coworkers can attest to that. I was, you know, I took advantage of the fact that in tech, a lot of times you can work from home a lot. You can work on your own hours and you can kind of make your own schedule.
As long as you finish the work, right?
Yeah. And, you know, there are some caveats to it, which is ultimately why I did leave, because it was just not going to be sustainable. But I took advantage of it. I was gigging all the time.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Every time I could, I was gigging. I took, I, it was just like the period of time where it was like, say yes to everything.
I love that.
I mean, it's hard. You do that and you're like, oh my God, I'm making like no money.
I'm making no money, but I'm making no money and then I'm doing so much work.
Yeah. But I did have the supplement of like having this other job, which was like a salaried job. Wow. And that I will admit like that was a very weird and probably unrealistic situation for anybody else. If other people like ask me like, oh, like, how did you do that? I'm like, it was lucky. Like I was lucky that this job was willing to trust me enough and that they liked me enough to let me do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I did for a bit. And then during that period of time when I was working at Pandora, I did work on Moulin Rouge. Like that was like, I had some like pretty, I would say like important projects mm-hmm. that I worked on during that period of time. But mm-hmm. then it was about, now it's been about 9 months that I left that job. And it just came to a head. It was like, okay, you know what? I've been like thinking to myself for the past few years, like if it comes to a point where I want to take that leap, like I need to take it now. I need to do it while I'm young. I don't have kids. I don't have I'm able to take a risk. And I fully understand that like people do that at all ages. And mm-hmm. like, I don't want to hate on that. But knowing my personality, at least I'm like, I can justify it to myself when I chose to leave that I was like, okay, great. I've saved up enough money for the past few years. I've made enough of a name for myself in the community where I feel like I won't necessarily be wanting for gigs once I take this leap. And then also I'm at a time period in my life where really the only person I fend for is myself. Obviously I have a partner and I have, you know, people that I care about in my life, but I don't need to be financially responsible for them like I would be for a kid.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like these are all privileges that we have as like, you know, we have first world problems and we have first world privileges. And I think
absolutely
for us to be able to do theater in itself and be able to do any form of artistry within the theater community, it's a privilege because there are people who are like fighting for their next meal.
Yeah.
And here we absolutely are making art.
And I recognize that. And it's very, I feel very like lucky at least to have been able to make that choice for myself.
And I'm very curious. So you've worked on a bunch of like really high profile gigs, right?
Yeah. It's been
you
start, cool.
You did Hadestown, you did In the Green, and you said you worked on Moulin Rouge. Did you work on the Broadway?
No, I just worked on it before I went to Boston. It was like this 4 week
And how
period.
Did you get in, like, how did you get connected? How did you start? What, take us through that process.
I mean, and it's always kind of who you know in some ways or who has enough faith in you to recommend you, right? Yeah. I think that I'm really grateful to, there was just a few people that really kind of like started the chain reaction, you know, and in the case of Moulin Rouge, actually in the case of both Moulin Rouge and L'Empique, it was, Hadestown, it was the same person. I worked on this production, this workshop of a show called L'Empique.
Yeah.
That's, you know, up and coming and working with those people. And, you know, Rachel was the same director as Hadestown and stuff like that. And it was kind of through that actually that I got recommended ultimately to both Moulin Rouge and Hadestown. Mm. So, it really just feels like, I mean, obviously we've all done the thing where we cold email people. I've done that and I don't necessarily not recommend doing that, but that will most likely not be as important as someone that the other person directly knows and trusts recommending you. And so I'm grateful for like those people in my life that did that. And also I can very clearly like trace that route for myself and
like trace it back a little bit for me. So like you said, before you did Hadestown and Moulin Rouge, it was L'Empique. So how did you get to do L'Empique? And L'Empique is written by Matt Gould and
Carson Kreitzer.
Great.
That's her last name.
Yeah. And they've been working on that show for a while. And, and I've only heard good things. I've not seen any iteration of it, but I'm sure it'll be fine. It's going to come.
I'm extremely biased, but it's like my favorite show.
Great. Great. And how did you get on that gig?
That was also a recommendation from someone else. And someone I knew from school. Then that was kind of like a big,
like a kickoff point for you.
Yeah. It was definitely like through those recommendations that I kind of, I don't know, calling it leveling up is such a weird term.
No,
but like,
I think it's like making,
you know,
the connection to get to where you need to go.
Yeah.
And
it was,
you know,
really
upgrading
cool.
Your project.
I felt so grateful for like that because it really felt like, you know, I don't know. It just felt like people, whenever someone recommends you for something, I feel like that's really cool because they did think of you in that moment.
So talk a little bit about your experience working on such high profile shows. Hadestown won 8 Tony Awards. How was that process, being in the room, assisting Anais Mitchell and the music team? How was all of that?
It was amazing. I mean, it was my first Broadway show. It was my Broadway debut, I guess you could say. And it was like, I mean, it was amazing. I was just so happy to be there like the whole time, like from day one or day negative five even. I was just like, oh my God, like this is so cool. I fell in love with the music when I was helping people like prepare for their auditions and stuff. That's how I actually found it. I knew that it existed, but I didn't listen to the music until that happened. And then I was like, oh my God, like I have to work on the show. Our creative team was very heavily female, and that was awesome. Yeah. I have to say, like, that was so cool. I mean, to have Rachel Chavkin at the helm of it, leading it all, like, that was obviously super important. But then, like, just the way that everyone was communicating, and I thought that it created this like excellent work atmosphere. And so the relationship and rapport between like Rachel and David, who was our choreographer, and then Liam, our music director, as well as of course Anais, who was there throughout the whole process. Mm-hmm. That was just like, it felt like an open collaboration, and everyone was being listened to and heard. And to be on the music team specifically, I mean, it was really cool because it did feel like there was so much attention paid to like every little thing in the music, whether it came to the orchestration, like our brilliant, amazing orchestrators, and watching them like kind of just hone in and try to like really fine tune a specific moment in the score. Like that was just like a masterclass in collaboration. And then also working with Anais, who like, you know, a lyric, that was a huge thing. So the lyrics, just like we would have these like all these like little changes like throughout the process, and it would be like, you know, changing a word here and there, and seeing how that changed the whole meaning of a line. Mm-hmm. I was really impressed by that as someone who kind of like, I would say, thinks more macro instead of micro. Like that was really cool to like really hone in, because they had, you know, off Broadway, they'd had Canada, and they also had London to work on the show. It really felt like in some ways, like there was just a lot of like little fine-tuning moments for Broadway, because
like they already knew what the show was on the big picture.
Yeah, I think in general, you know, like a lot of the overall picture, like I would say maybe remained the same between London and Broadway, but there were so many little details that got changed, and I think that really made a huge difference too. And of course there were some big changes, but like overall, I think, I mean, looking between off Broadway and Broadway, that's a huge difference. And between London and Broadway, obviously less of a difference.
And you came on to the show for the Broadway, right? Yeah. And talk a little bit about like what your job scope was. You know, they say music assistant. Like, yeah. What does that entail?
Music, I mean, it changes for each show, but for this show, you're basically keeping up with all the changes that are happening in the rehearsal process. So that is like day one, obviously little zhuzhes here and there. And then once you get the band in, it's like, oh my gosh, like here are all these changes. And our copyist we had a copyist as well, but he was like doing remote work. So it ended up being kind of a collaboration between me and him as well sometimes. Mm-hmm. And of course, the best part of the job is the printing. I kid, because it was actually like terrifying how much paper we used, unfortunately. Oh, yeah. I'm like, I totally, oh my God.
Changes every day.
I know. It's like unfortunate, actually. I'm really like kind of like, oh my gosh, when are we all going to be on iPads? But anyway,
I'm surprised that that's not part of the stage management's duties.
No, I mean, you know, they have enough stuff to print. So yeah. For me, that was like, I was only music stuff that I was printing.
So like the band stuff.
Band and like scores, you know, because like there would be like little things in previews, you know, like stuff is still changing, like lyrics. We would like, there was this one song where we just like kept on like cutting half a chorus and seeing if it worked and then putting it back in and stuff. And it's so much an organizational job. Like that's really what it is. It requires you to have a good ear and a good musical mind and a good, obviously, musical knowledge. But what differentiates, I would say, like a good music assistant from like a maybe not as good one would be the level of organization you're able to keep, because like that is like almost more important in some ways than like your musical mind. I mean, you also just have to be like generally very excited and willing to help. I think, you know, it's very tiring work because you don't play, like, which is, I think a lot of music assistants ultimately want to play, myself included. Like that was and is like my goal is to have hands on keys. And this is not that. This is like you are sitting behind a computer, which is ironic because that's what I used to do, you know, my old job. So, you know, I will admit, like, it gets it can become very tiresome. And like, mm-hmm. I don't think it's sustainable to do for the rest of your life, because if you have like other aspirations, then you really get pent up almost. You're like, oh my God, like,
yeah. But on the flip side, it's like you are in the room where it happens, yeah. right? Like,
and
you
that's
are
why,
watching
that is exactly why a lot of people
all
do
the,
it.
Yeah, exactly. All the magic that happens.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to learn from that.
Absolutely. And it is an amazing way to learn because, you know, there's always something to learn. And I feel as someone who's like young in my career in this yeah. way, like I can just like being in the room with like other music directors is like an amazing experience in that way, just to even observe it. Mm-hmm. Assistant work is like, that is like the best way to get into the room.
Yeah, 100%. How is the process different for Hadestown and In the Green?
First of all, so many similarities. I mean, like, that's like really the crux of it, is that the work is actually a lot the same. Mm-hmm. But the differences there were kind of like, In the Green, they were like way bigger changes in the sense that like there would be like a new song, like, and that was intense, like to put that in the show the next day.
So like you had to do all the transcription, you had to prepare mm-hmm. all the scores for that.
Yeah. You know, and there was actually one point where I was like on vacation, like with my family in Disneyland. My sister graduated from college.
Yay, sister.
So, yeah. So this was like, you know, a conflict that I had cleared before, but you know, I was like, I can do work remotely and stuff. And so they were putting a new song into the show.
That's a lot. That's like, so to I can't, do a song, and transcribe your song in the day, clean it. Was there a copy?
Oh, no. It was the other way around. I was in Disneyland during the day. I would come back at night and then transcribe the song. I'd be like on Splash Mountain. I'm like, okay, time to go back. I have to like transcribe the song. Yeah, that was somewhat stressful, but it all got done.
Yeah, of course.
But yeah, and the orchestrations were slightly different. Like at least it was really a lot of orchestrating, I think, like on the spot. It felt like a lot was happening in the room. Mm-hmm. So then,
including working with the band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. Totally. So it was a little bit less of like maybe the traditional orchestrator work where the orchestrator takes it and like does it, and then you print it, and then you try it, and then you make more changes. It felt very much like, okay, like what works here, do this, like, and they like scribble it into their parts, and then I take it down and then like print a fresh copy. And it was so cool to watch because it felt more like
organic and
band,
like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And especially for that show, this little off-Broadway show, it was important to kind of like hear it first, especially because they were using some kind
also,
of
also yeah also they were experimenting with things that usually don't
yeah,
go
exactly
with,
we had,
you know, a band or
yeah,
an orchestra.
We had a kanun, which is a middle eastern type of like zither instrument, so that alone was kind of like, okay, we have to hear how this sounds, like it's just hard to visualize, and so that was important to like be able to hear it. And so they were doing a lot of experimentation like in the rehearsal room, and then like the job was to like write it all down and then like print a fresh copy for the show that night or something. So
it's great.
Yeah, it's fast. That's the thing. You just, I mean, the thing is that you do have to have a good ear, because you have to just like be able to like hear and be like, okay, this is like what happens, like this is how it goes. Like I can't just like spend time like plunking it out on the piano myself.
Yeah,
you know, I it's only been my first year as a true freelancer, so
yeah,
I'm kind
and
of
you're
like,
thriving, so it's
I feel
like,
very happy, but I feel very blessed. It felt like, I mean, I don't know, like I'm not particularly religious or in any way, but I felt like it was the right choice. And I will say this, because I've told this to a few people, which is that when I was at my other job, like I had these such distinct memories of talking with my manager, who was an amazing manager, great person, and we got along so well. And but I would just be like, I don't want to be promoted, like please don't promote me, I don't wow. want any more responsibility, just let me code, like being like a little monkey, like code and submit the code, and I don't want to make decisions, I don't want to be in charge of anything, don't ever want to be a manager. And like now I don't feel that way at all. I feel the opposite. I feel so hungry to do more, to, you know, help the people that I, you know, I trust their work, or that people whose work I'm passionate about, mm-hmm. like help them, and also like take on more responsibility either on my own behalf or on behalf of them. Mm-hmm. And I think that is to me like the biggest sign that what I made, the choice that I made was the right choice, because like I have ambition now. I feel like I have drive, and I have like something that's kind of like keeping me hungry and excited for the future. And that is something I didn't have before. I was very happy, I was content, I was pleased in the sense that like I had you know, a salary and I had resources and stability, things like that. But it was, there was this other thing that was like missing, which was the, this idea that I would progress in my career. You know, I didn't have that. And now I have that. And that is something that I value so greatly. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, when I do get down on myself sometimes about being like, oh, like if only I had just like, you know, out of school come here and just hustled from the beginning. It's like, well, no, I actually think for me, I needed to see what it was like to do the other thing and not necessarily have that ambition. And then like compare that with how I feel now.
And then you'll have, it's a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 100%. And this is something that I'm going to like do a little left turn, but also like very, very relevant to everything that you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Is that we don't, in our industry at least, it's starting to be more of a conversation topic, but how has it been to be in the industry, in the theater industry in New York as an Asian person and as a woman? Like, we don't really see POC music directors who are female. Like, we see, we're starting to see the rise of female artists in power, like female producers, female directors, but we still don't see, like, I can name maybe five very prominent female music directors, but they're all white females. Not to take that away from them, because I think that's really wonderful.
Of course.
But then it's like you're one minority plus another minority. How does that come into play in this industry, and how does that affect you and how you conquer what you want to do?
No, I you become very, I think, aware of it own in those circumstances. Like for example, I went to an audition like the other day where I was playing piano, and I walked in the room and literally every person that was auditioning there was an older white man. Mm-hmm. And I knew some of them, which was great, but it is like I kind of almost forgot like how that feels, like to walk into a room and be like, oh my god, like I really feel like kind of the black sheep here.
Mm-hmm.
I've been really lucky to work on projects that actually had a huge female and person of color team.
And I think that's like because that's the energy you draw and that's the
sure,
people you attract as well.
That, yeah, and 100%. Maybe that's part of it. And I think that I'm lucky in the sense that I think now there seems to be at least a drive now for a lot of people to really diversify their teams, whether or not they want to, but that's not really of my concern. It's like, great, it's happening. Like, because it needs to happen, right? And so,
because you get different viewpoints into the room, so it's not one homogenous viewpoint.
Right, and I think that was partially what made Hadestown so successful, was just like having all those different viewpoints. And whenever I see a show where I'm like, this is just kind of weird, like this dialogue is written weirdly, or this like, you know, why did they write this character like this? And then I'm like, oh, like the entire team is like dudes? Like, maybe they should have like, you know, even consulted a woman when they like were writing this female character.
100%.
I don't know, but yeah, I think that in terms of like my identity coming into play, like when with my career, I would say that I feel like I'm able to communicate well with lots of different people, and maybe that's just a facet of having grown up like not necessarily as the like majority. I will also say like I've been approached. Well, not approached, but like, you know, reached out to by several like young Asian American music directors, I guess, or music director types, or people who are interested in getting into this industry. And I realize now, like, that is, I feel very flattered by that. Like, that's so cool that someone, you know, has looked at me and been like, oh, like that's cool that like she does that, and I want to do that too. Because it's true, I didn't have that, and I wonder maybe if I would have gotten into the industry like earlier, if I had seen other people doing that. Because, you know, I mean, growing up, like, my mom would say, and you know, I don't want to like out her as saying this, but she'd be like, you know, like, why do you like doing this kind of stuff? Like, there's always just going to be like some other like American person who's going to like do the job like better, or because they like, you know more people, it's more part of their blood. At the time, it felt very much like, dude, like, don't ever forget, like, you will be thought of as an other. And that was probably how she did feel at the time, like, and maybe still in some ways like feels now, is that like, you know, you can try as much as you like, but you're always going to be, you know, they'll never really see you as their own. And that was like a bummer to hear at the time. And I understand totally that that's probably like a result of a lot of different experiences that led her to say that. But yeah, it's true. When you looked at like the stage, you never saw Asian people on the stage. Mm-hmm. I never did ever. So like that was just enough to make, you know, people like my parents be like, that's not for us. Mm-hmm. This art form is not for us. Classical piano, on the other hand, is an art form for us because there's so many of us. So, you know, that's the thing. It's like, it's just like what you see is sometimes it really does dictate how you feel as an impressionable person. Absolutely. Not even an impressionable young person, but an impressionable older person. Like when you see, like, you know, I don't want my kid to grow up feeling like the other in this community of mm-hmm. people that are like all white, and like then they like, this is their parents are like happy to like send them to like musical theater camp and whatever, but like, you know, my kid is not going to feel comfortable there because I all this to say, basically I feel so happy now that it feels like there's more visibility mm-hmm. You know, you and me, and we're part of this community that like it feels like there is like a flourishing kind of like community of Asian and Asian American performers and artists. And I think feel so happy about that.
And it's definitely growing. And I think the whole point, I mean, as you were talking about that, I was like, that's the whole point of this podcast, is to like put that visibility out there. People are doing these things and people are doing it well, you know, and people are thriving. So it's a common thread, a common theme with a lot of my guests are just like, we've never seen ourselves represented in the media in any way growing up, in American media at least.
Definitely not American media, yeah.
And how does that affect you? And as a performer who's doing this now, how can you pave the way for the next generation of people who are desperately seeking that, right? And I wouldn't say that they're trying to search for validation, but I think they're saying like, hey, look at this person can do it, so can I, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that's beautiful.
I know it sounds, I feel like I hear that all the time. It's like, what? It sounds almost like cheesy, but that's like that. But it is true. Like is ultimately that. Yeah. And when you see someone else doing it, you're like, oh, like then you can like visualize yourself in that place. And mm-hmm. that is important. Mm-hmm.
We've talked a lot about your entire life, and just so insightful, so exciting.
Thanks.
And I have a few questions before we, you know, close out. The very first one is, if you could tell little Cynthia growing up one thing, what would you tell her?
It would be that all those like hours that you spent like at the piano learning how to play by ear are going to be so helpful for you. Really, like, and I think that's important, because I think at the time I was at least told by others that it was maybe a waste of time. All you do is really, you don't have to learn to play by ear like those like uncultured people. So I feel like very vindicated at least about that. Like, no, just keep going. In fact, you should have like learned to play jazz earlier. So maybe I would have told myself that, and also that things get better, the relationships that you build with your parents will change over time for the better and for the worse, and things always are in a state of change. So mm-hmm. it is never just the way, it will never always be the way it is at that given moment. Mm-hmm. You always can expect it to change.
I'm so curious, I mean this is not really part of the question, but I'm so curious, how's your relationship with your parents, and how's your relationship with your siblings?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I am a little hesitant to put most of it on the air, but I will paraphrase and say that it was a strain for some time. We are very different people, and there were some other factors that kind of like led to that, outside of even like my career choices. But it was tough, and now it has really gone quite a bit better, and I think
everything changed.
I think enough time passed, you know, time passing helps, you know, people just have time to think over things, and I had time to think over things, and we definitely had a lot of fights in the last few years. That was, you know, it was unfortunate to go through, but the relationship is good, I would say, and that is something I'm very grateful for, because I did not think it was going to be good like for a long time.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's part of it. It's like you at the moment you're like, wow, this is how it's going to be forever. Like it's going to be horrible forever. And then it just changes because time can do that, which I am happy to have learned, I guess.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. How would you define success?
I'm still learning that for myself. So I can only give you the answer that exists at this moment, yeah. which is just that when you come out of whatever you're doing at that moment, like an extended period of time doing something that you feel that no matter what you got out of it monetarily or physically or things like that, or even praise from your peers or people who were important, that you feel fulfilled in that way. And that is, it's a hard thing to grasp. It's only something, you only really know it when you feel it. And then you're like, oh, this is what it feels like to like, first of all, I don't give a fuck what anyone else thinks mm-hmm. about this particular thing that I just did. But I feel that I either worked hard, you know, or that I worked hard for something and that I either performed my best or put out something that I feel fulfilled by. So it's kind of a vague answer in that way, but it's such a personal thing, and it's really just about not like other factors withstanding mm-hmm. you feeling like you are fulfilled.
If you can ask me one question,
yeah,
and one question only, what would you like to find out?
Oh, I have so many questions for you, Chiang. First of all, is there musical theater in Singapore, and like, and how is that scene, if any, like, different than here?
I was never involved in musical theater in Singapore. There actually is a growing musical theater,
really,
kind of culture and all that in Singapore. But I was, because like when I was growing up in Singapore, I had no exposure to the theater. The only media I was exposed to was television. So, and television was like the god, basically. Like, if you're on TV, you were like, you made it, you know. But people keep forgetting that fame is there's this quote by Hasan Minhaj that, like, I'm like, that's a great quote. It's like, fame is like a rental car. You get in it, you drive it, and then you have to return it. Okay. It's something that's fleeting. It's not something uh-huh. that you can have forever. It doesn't mean anything. So everyone was very obsessed with TV. And I was never exposed to theater or other forms of art. Mainly because my parents didn't know it. And as a kid, I'm not like actively looking out for all yeah. these things. And I mean, I'm that old that the internet, you know, was part of my life. But like, it was like the dial up, you know, like it was.
I should have asked you how old you are. That's the question. Now I'll never know. You're just so dewy and smooth skin.
Don't know. You'll never know. Well, anyway, but I wish I was exposed to theater way earlier. And I didn't. I saw my first musical on Broadway in 2010 because I was here on vacation and a callback in America. Like,
what?
I know.
That's what was the show? Was it Wicked? Or
I saw my, well, the first Broadway ticket I bought was Wicked. But the first show I saw was Mary Poppins.
Okay, yeah. Right.
But Wicked was completely life-changing. I can yes. always remember I was sitting on the aisle, orchestra left.
Aww.
My friend was sleeping, Elphaba was belting, and I was crying. That image will never leave my mind. I don't know if that's if that's true. Like, I think it's true. I mean, it's only been a few years. But like, that image will always remain in my mind. Yeah. And I know that I was like, I want to do this.
Did you like that episode of East Side Story? If you did, follow us on Instagram at East Side Story Pod and at Chiang Music. Go on to Apple Podcasts, rate us, review us, and don't forget to subscribe. Or if you're a Spotify user, you can also click the follow button. Even better, you can tell someone about the podcast. And the best part, they don't even have to be Asian. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you next week. This episode of East Side Story is presented in partnership with Listening Party. Follow the crew on Instagram at Listening Party Presents and at Canal Street Market.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com. And of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.